And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM. And we're very pleased to bring with us today Zafar Bengash. And that's Zafar Bengash from Crescent International. Zafar Bengash, Islamic scholar and journalist, and frequent guest on our program. So, Zafar, thanks very much for coming with us today.
It's my great pleasure, Brandon. Nice to talk to you.
Yes. I've been meaning to speak with you for a bit because there's so much going on right now. And we'll have to revisit some of the issues in future days because we won't be able to cover everything. But there's a lot of fires that have to be put out around the world, I guess. We were just talking about the coup in Honduras, and now there's the other disaster, well, one of the other disasters, which was the recent legislation that was passed in Switzerland. And I understand you must have an opinion on that. For our listeners who might not have heard about it, there's a ban involved here. Actually, Zafar, could you tell us a bit about this ban?
Yes, this is something absolutely incredible that the Swiss government held a referendum, and in that the point was whether people in Switzerland supported the ban that the government has imposed on mosque minarets, that mosques should not have minarets. And the vote, although a large percentage of the people abstained from voting, in fact only 4 out of the 20 or so cantons actually participated in it, but according to their, you know, strange law, that still passed. But of the people who did vote, out of the, you know, 7 million people in Switzerland, only about 2.7 million voted. And there was a 57% vote against allowing Muslims to build minarets in their mosques. Now, it's a very strange kind of situation because, you know, for instance, when people build churches, there are church towers and so on. A minaret is basically a symbol of a religious place. And in a society like Switzerland, to put that ban and then put it into law, it sounds extremely strange to me. To say the least, because one would have thought that Switzerland was a country which was tolerant, which was respectful of other people's religious beliefs and so on, and that people who are living within Switzerland of whatever faith should be able to practice their faith and to reflect their religious places of worship according to the way they feel that they ought to do. And here we have a situation whereby it has been made into law that Muslims cannot build minarets on their mosques.
Wow. Well, let's talk about the advertising that led up to this, or the way they justified that. Now, I've looked at least one of the posters that was involved in this campaign, and it portrayed the minarets. And of course, the minarets are kind of like their steeples; they're tall sections of the mosque. And these minarets were portrayed as nuclear missiles.
Right. Exactly. You know, the kind of negative portrayal that was made out of these. To sort of, you know, conjure up images of violence and missiles and bombs and so on. You know, obviously it was a very strange way of depicting it, and quite Islamophobic, I must say, because regrettably in Europe we have had a number of problems with the Danish cartoons showing the Prophet's turban with a bomb on it and other kinds of, you know, very provocative things that have been done over there. And now we have a situation in Switzerland whereby pictures have been drawn of minarets that are shaped in the form of missiles, indicating that somehow Muslims' religious places are places of violence. Now, this is a direct attack on Islam and Muslims. And, you know, there is a sizable population of Muslims living in Switzerland, about 100,000 of them. And I would view these kinds of depictions as a direct threat to their safety, because in every society there are people who regrettably are not very rational in their thinking. And people could easily be swayed by these kinds of pictures and depictions, and it could endanger Muslim lives. Now, it doesn't take a very large number of people. Only a few hotheads can create problems. So I'm afraid what the Swiss government has done is completely contrary to religious tolerance, religious values, human rights, rights of citizens, and rights of people living in any society.
I imagine you're stoking fear and violence when you portray the four minarets that are in Switzerland as a strategic nuclear threat.
Exactly.
The other way they were justifying it, of course, was through women's rights, as always. So on the poster, there's a picture of a woman in a chador, and you can't really identify a lot of her features. They have, basically, it's a woman in a chador superimposed in front of a bunch of missile minarets.
That's correct.
So it's, you know, that whole orientalization, you're dealing with different people again. And indeed, it's my understanding that part of the justification for limiting this visible presence of Islam in Switzerland was because of the importance of supporting women's rights, just like we were supporting women's rights in Afghanistan, and now like they're even trying to say they're supporting women's rights in Iraq after the invasion. So it's part of that whole same deal. And I just find that's kind of humorous, perhaps in a sardonic way. It's my understanding that in Switzerland, women did not get the vote until 1971. And some women did not even. Yeah, I know. I mean, it's the other thing, of course, is it's even been suggested that in some cantons, women did not receive the vote until the 1980s or 1990s.
Right.
So, you know, in the context of the Western world and its view on women's rights, Switzerland is exceptionally backwards.
Yes, exactly. And you know, the other argument that is being advanced through this is that somehow if a woman is wrapped in a chador or wearing a hijab or something, that she is being oppressed. They should consider the other side, that if women choose to dress like that, then we should allow them that right. It is their choice. And you know, if they feel that their religious belief requires them to dress that way, then I think we should not adopt this attitude of superiority, that we are the only ones, or that, you know, Western Swiss culture and values are the only ones that grant rights to women. You know, I think it would be worthwhile to talk to these women that, for instance, wear the hijab or dress themselves in a chador, to ask them whether they feel oppressed, whether they feel in any way inferior. And I know for a fact that women that wear this, they make that their own choice, it's their personal choice, and that there is absolutely no way to reflect their inferiority. In fact, it restores their dignity because they are making a statement that they are not available for every man to joke around with or flirt around with, that these women would like to maintain their dignity and respect by dressing in this particular manner.
Well, that's just it, isn't it? They're singling out Islam for its differences and its choices and the choices people make within that religion. And I think, actually, it was the Angry Arab, that blogger on the internet, that helped me understand this in a different way. He wrote, I think just the other day, he said, "How would the Western media have reacted if the ban affected synagogues and not mosques? You know, would you have seen stories against it on the front pages of all U.S. newspapers? If the ban affected synagogues, for example, the U.S. government would have convened a special session of the U.S. Security Council and a special U.N. Commission on Human Rights."
So, absolutely, exactly. You know, if it had been synagogues that were targeted in this way, I'm absolutely convinced that not only a U.N. Security Council meeting would have been convened, there would have been resolutions passed in the U.S. Congress. There would have been demands that Switzerland should be boycotted, that people should withdraw their money from Swiss banks, and that Swiss planes should not be allowed to fly to the U.S. And there'll be, you know, demonstrations in the streets with the President of the United States and virtually his entire cabinet behind him protesting this thing. But here we have a situation where mosques are being targeted, and this is sort of, you know, taken as if it's quite natural. It seems to me, and there is ample evidence for this, that Muslims are being portrayed as the bad guys today. So anything that that is done to them, it's justified one way or another. So regrettably, that's the environment that we live in today.
Well, basically, yes. I know that the New York Times first sentence in covering the story, as the angry Arab pointed out, was, and this was the first sentence in the New York Times article, they say, in a vote that displayed a widespread anxiety about Islam, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, that's not taken as natural. It's
exactly
taken as understandable.
That's correct. As if there is something sort of, you know, wrong with Islam and Muslims, then that, you know, people should feel anxiety about it, ignoring the fact that Muslims are the second, or Islam is the second largest religion in many countries in Europe. And, you know, Muslims are now becoming second or third generation citizens of those countries, and yet we see this kind of a, you know, attitude. And, of course, on the broader canvas, we see, you know, as you mentioned earlier with respect to Afghanistan, that, you know, the U.S. Decision announced yesterday by President Obama that he's going to send an additional 30,000 troops to Afghanistan clearly indicates that there is a colonial enterprise underway, and that, you know, the U.S. and its allies wish to impose their values and their systems on the Afghan society, even though the Afghans wish to have nothing to do with it. They have their own processes. Whether we like them or not, they don't want to impose their systems on us or their values on us. So what right do the Americans or the Canadians or the British or any other Europeans have to go to Afghanistan and tell them how they should order their lives?
Well, the entire rationale for every aspect of this hideous war is pretty much falling apart. It's been coming apart for a long time, and now with the torture revelations, even more so. When you talk about Obama, I mean, there is a lot of hope that he would not fulfill his own promise to expand the war in Afghanistan, because he was running and he was talking about Afghanistan being the good war and the need to shift troops from Iraq to Afghanistan. And that is what he has been doing, and I think there's been some disappointment among people that were hoping he would not actually do that. But now we have a further escalation. So, as you say, 30,000 more troops. And I guess one of the questions is, why is he doing this? Does he even want to do that? Because there's been some indications that Obama had thought it would be a good idea if the U.S. could extricate itself from Afghanistan and save its own skin. But there's been talks about power struggles behind Obama. So I think Gareth Porter in Counterpunch was saying that Obama was looking for possible future ways out, but his generals want to stay in. So McChrystal says that 80,000 troops is the low-risk option for staying in Afghanistan, and 20,000 troops, only 20,000, is the high-risk option. So, I mean, it should be the other way around, you think. You'd think that sending more troops is higher risk. He sounds like a used car salesman. You know, you got to buy the more troops, put more troops in, buy the more expensive car. So,
exactly, yes. Well, you see, I know that within the U.S. administration, definitely there was heated debate, and number one, Obama inherited a very bad situation. But I think if he had acted as a statesman rather than as a politician beholden to certain vested interests, he would have done a great service to the U.S. and to the U.S. men and women in uniform, because they are the ones who are being sent to wars to poor people, children of poor people from rural areas, from other places, sent to a distant war to kill other poor people and to die in the process. If Obama had been a statesman, and I'm reminded of something that de Gaulle did back in 1958 when he ran for presidency of France, he had run a campaign that he was not going to withdraw French troops from Algeria, that he was going to, if he became president, he would prosecute the war and win the war and make sure that Algeria remained part of France. But as soon as he became the president, very soon after that, he announced that I've looked at the situation. The situation is hopeless, and we do not wish to prolong this war, and I'm going to withdraw French troops from Algeria and grant Algeria independence. And he did that within a three-year period after being elected. Now, that's a statesman-like position to take. Now, Obama, if he was truly a statesman, as soon as he became the president, he should have said, this is a disastrous war, it is getting us nowhere, and we are not achieving anything. In fact, the situation in Afghanistan is much worse than it was when we went in there. The best thing is to, you know, we pull out and let them sort their own things out. If they want our help, we'll give it to them, but we are not going to fight their wars for them. He would have acted like a statesman. Now he has got sucked into this. He is trapped. So no matter what he does, this war is going to be like an albatross around his neck. Because if he had, and I can clearly see, if he had refused to send more troops to Afghanistan when it was demanded by McChrystal, I think, I'm pretty convinced that somebody in the military, and the American military, of course, is extremely right-wing, that somebody in the military would have taken a shot at him and killed him. Either the military or some other right-wing crackpot would have got rid of Obama, because he already faces pressure in terms of being an African-American, and there is still quite a bit of racism in the United States. And there's a lot of resentment in the U.S. and the right-wing sort of, you know, establishment that he does not belong in the White House. You know, they're resentful of the fact that there's a black man in the White House. So that's the problem that they face.
Yes, there's a lot of recognition of the structural constraints Obama faces. Even if he were not African-American, it doesn't matter because of the vested interests you mentioned, especially the defense industry, which seems to continue to need wars to justify its own existence, and so forth. And I think it was Paul Craig Roberts who called Obama the most ineffective president in America's history or recent history just because of his complete inability to do what's actually wanted. So people wanted the healthcare change, and he hasn't really been able to deliver on that. People wanted out of Afghanistan and Iraq. He hasn't really been able to deliver on that. And any sort of change that people were wanting, that the whole mandate for which he got into office, is he seems unable to actually deliver that. And now he's got this albatross, as you say, and I think it reminds me of what Zoltan Grossman said, which is that Afghanistan is the roach motel of empires. So they check in and they don't check out. And, you
know. Exactly. You know, Michael Moore had sent a letter to Obama just 2 days ago, and in that he also mentioned, he said that, when the Russian generals or the Soviet generals decided to invade Afghanistan, that was the last nail they drove in the Soviet coffin. And he also said that, you know, here is the number for Putin, call him and find out what to do. And he gave the number, and he said, I lost the number for Genghis Khan, because he also tried to invade Afghanistan. So he said, Mr. President, don't do it. You have a chance to save your presidency as well as save America from an ignominious defeat. Don't go in there. Don't send any more troops. In fact, prepare to withdraw American forces from there. But regrettably, you know, as we've been saying, Obama is a prisoner of the establishment. You know, on October 29th, the RAND Corporation held a meeting on Afghanistan at which Zbigniew Brzezinski spoke. And in that, he clearly outlined, he said that there are three no's that America mustn't fall in. And the first was absolutely no withdrawal from Afghanistan. And the second was that it mustn't go it alone and so on. I mean, there are, you know, the other things. And one of the things that he said later on, which was quite striking, was, and he said that we must not forget, and this is something revealing, and this is something that the American press and the establishment tiptoe around, but Brzezinski spoke out about it. He said that we must not forget that we have to build that oil and gas pipeline from Central Asia through Afghanistan into India and to the Pakistani port to take it out to the West. So here was this so-called sage of American foreign policy inadvertently blurting out that this whole war is about natural resources from Central Asia. And that's why Obama cannot get his forces out of there. He cannot end this war, but it is going to end up in disaster for him. And I'm convinced that he will not be able to begin that withdrawal in 18 months' time as he promised. And this was basically a sop to his own constituency, his own supporters, that he's, although he's escalating the war, but he has a timeline as well for withdrawal, and I doubt very much if he'll be able to make that stick.
Well, yes, it's just that sort of mushy, middle-in-the-road, centrist compromise that Obama likes to do. So a lot of his most progressive supporters and a lot of ordinary Americans would like to see zero troops added to Afghanistan.
Exactly.
And the military wants to see 80,000, so he says, well, split the difference, I'll do 30,000, that'll be accepted.
Right. Right.
And of course, it's not just an albatross around his neck now, but so many Americans too. We saw the shooting on Fort Hood and some of the tensions that are involved in American society right now. And now I'm told the suicide rate is the highest it's been, and that as far back as anyone can remember, there's probably going to be as many suicides as combat deaths from Iraq and Afghanistan together.
Absolutely. And since 2003, there have already been 76 deaths in the United States by veterans. Either they have shot somebody or they have killed themselves or and so on. And as you said, the suicide rate has shot alarmingly. And the number of people suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder is exceedingly high in the U.S. military. And this is something that is not being talked about, that is not being addressed. It's a major problem and a very serious problem that is affecting military families and so on. And I think if, if the Americans don't care for Afghan lives, although that is racist, but even if they don't care for other people's lives, I think they should care for their own people's lives and well-being. And these wars are absolutely insane. The Afghans never attacked America. No Afghan has ever attacked America. And even now when these people argue that, well, you know, they pose a threat to the United States, that's a blatant lie. The Afghans are not interested in attacking America. They just want to be left alone. They want to order their lives according to their own values. They don't want to accept American or British or anybody else's values.
I'll tell you what, the war in Afghanistan is a threat to the United States. Its actual war threatens U.S. interests more than Afghans actually could or would want to threaten U.S. interests. So,
exactly.
And of course, now it's threatening Canada's interests too, just like it has been all along, but more intensely. So we have this horrific torture scandal that's come about. And it's not really a scandal, is it? Because we knew about this torture since at least 2007, maybe 2006, but now it's come out again with Colvin, and I guess you're just seeing the circus here with Harper denying everything and then having to backtrack and say that Colvin wasn't feeding him the information all along, even though Colvin was sending everyone on Parliament Hill. I guess he tried to put on his CC email list just about every name he could think of what he was seeing in Afghanistan, because that was his job to report on the Canadian presence. So a lot of people knew about this, and basically the governments, possibly as far back as the Liberal governments, were trying to squelch all of the things that were coming out.
Exactly. I mean, I think that the way Harper is arguing is that Colvin did not send a direct email to me. I mean, surely, it's not Colvin's job. I mean, he would send it to his superiors, and he sent it to Harper's advisors. There is, the Mulroney, who was Harper's, task force point man on Afghanistan. He sent it to the deputy foreign minister and foreign affairs minister, and anybody that was of any consequence in the prime minister's office got those emails, 17 of them between April of 2006 and September of 2007. And it's outrageous that, Harper would make statements like that and McKay constantly sort of, denying that, he ever knew about it or that, and the manner in which he has tried to tarnish Richard Colvin's reputation. I mean, it's very, really very disturbing that, a person who not only did his job but who had the integrity to say, well, look, these were the terrible things that were happening, and regrettably, even when I pointed out, I was told by David Mulroney not to put it in writing, but to only make verbal communications. What does that indicate? What does that tell us? That tells us clearly that these people did not wish to stop these kinds of practices. They did not want these things to be put in writing, because this would have ultimately, it would come to haunt them. So here we have a situation whereby all of this information, known to the government, known to high officials and their advisors, and even the top military officials, and yet they're all in denial mode. They're all trying to discredit a very honest, decent man who's concerned about Canada's reputation, who's concerned about international law, who's concerned about human rights, who's concerned about Canadian law, and yet he's being trashed and trounced and tarnished and jumped upon because he did his job.
I know, yeah. Canadian diplomats and foreign service members are very upset about the way that Colvin's been treated by the government, at least from what I've read in the newspaper columns. And in fact, twice as many Canadians actually believe Colvin's than Harper's version of events. There was actually a Canadian press survey that found 51% of respondents believe Colvin's statement that the prisoners handed over by Canadian soldiers to Afghan authorities were likely to be abused. And only 25% believed Harper's assertion that Colvin's claims were flimsy and not credible. So
that's right.
I mean, Canadians see through it, but it goes to the sad story about what was actually happening, because I was speaking with Stephen Gowans on the program last week, and I just mentioned that basically we were turning people over to whipping with power cables and electricity as torture, and knives, right, and open flames and so on. So basically what happens is if you're an ordinary Afghan and you're just living your life trying to make a living in various ways, what happens is soldiers descend upon your village, in this case Canadian soldiers, and you are then handed over to be tortured. I mean, there's no justification, and you can imagine the horror that is actually involved in that.
Absolutely. Like, you know, and Colvin mentioned in his reports that all of the people that were handed over were ordinary farmers or cab drivers or, you know, ordinary Afghans. I mean, this would not be justified. This kind of mistreatment would not be justified even if they were Taliban or Taliban supporters. But the fact that these people are just totally innocent bystanders, farmers, et cetera, and yet they are being tortured in this manner. Naturally, this is the worst possible way to win people's hearts and minds. And Colvin pointed out that it was as a result of this policy of handing over ordinary Afghans to be tortured that actually escalated the violence against Canadian troops and led to more Canadian deaths than it would have if this policy had not been pursued.
Exactly. Well, the whole idea of innocence and resistance and so on is something we should discuss in the future as well. We're going to want to take a look at events in Pakistan. There's been some developments there and further things about the strategy of the war in Afghanistan and Pakistan generally. So I know we'd love to speak with you about that. So
certainly. It'll be a pleasure.
Thank you so much for coming.
Brandon, you take care.
You too, Zafar.
Okay, bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.